Blog Talk Radio.
This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Dean. Well, I must admit that I didn't bowl all that well this week, and that's a horrible experience because we were in first place, but now we're ending up in third. In any event, I'm happy to provide you with a presentation on one of the greatest musicians of all time, and that is the great Duke Ellington. I call him the Duke of Ellington. You're going to be hearing a presentation of people who were associated with Duke, some of them who still are alive and some of them have passed on. So I'm going to read you a list, and in that particular order, you will hear those particular individuals talk. Willie the Lion Smith will be the very person that you'll hear first. Duke Ellington himself, and then there'll be Irvin Mills, Herb Jeffries, Adeline Hall, Clark Terry, Cootie Williams, Russell Procol, Leonard Feathers, Jimmy Hamilton, Louis Belson, Johnny Hodges, Ben Webster, Cootie Anderson or Cat Anderson, and Teddy Wilson. So without any further ado, let's get started with this documentation on one of the greatest jazz musicians who ever lived.
Take up the challenge of the city.
Duke said, "God, I'll get back to my son. I'm going to let you. I'll stay on that one subject." So anyhow, they had a publishing place in New York, and by the name of Avon Mills, who had recently been associated with Duke and Boys. Avon and brother-in-law, the son, and how to make a long story short. They wanted a band leader. They had the Blue Rhythm Band, all kinds of bands. Lucky Melinda, you made all the I took one look behind and talked to the man on Ranch of Lucas, and he was really trapping him, handsome, and tall. I said, above all, he can improvise and memorize. So they put Duke in front of the band. I don't have to tell you what happened to the censor.
And now we come to one who seems to be set entirely apart from all other composers and musicians. When I first heard him, he was conducting a little five-piece orchestra up in Harlem. Today is acclaimed by music authorities both here and abroad as the creator of the new golden music, Duke Ellington.
But Ellington was a very shrewd businessman. He had a great apprenticeship with a man by the name of Irving Mills, who was probably one of the shrewdest businessmen in music publishing business that ever existed. He built an empire, and of course, some of them became partners in a thing called Mills Ellington Publishing Firm.
Originally, they hired Ellington to record his own compositions and arrangements. According to him, his success in breaking down racial barriers in the recording and entertainment industry came as a result of his association with Mills. It was him who was responsible for getting the Duke Ellington Orchestra its engagement.
The Cotton Club. The name itself was a reflection of the exotic stereotypes that white society had created during the 1920s about black people. Situated in the heart of Harlem, the club featured the music and performances of black artists. But the Cotton Club had a policy of whites only.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our famous Cotton Club. If you'll spare a minute in your merrymaking, I'd like to have the pleasure of introducing the greatest living master of jungle music, the rip-roaring harmony hound, none other than Duke Ellington. Thank you, bow, Dukey.
As band leader, Ellington had to design many of his musical arrangements to back the Cotton Club production powers. Nevertheless, Ellington was able to generate a unique style for big band orchestration and compositions, which would profoundly influence the future of jazz. Under the heading of jungle music, Ellington introduced such timeless compositions as East St. Louis Toodaloo, The Mooch, Mood Indigo, Black and Tan Fantasy, and the first wordless jazz vocal, Creole Love Call.
And we started playing all these beautiful tunes. Well, when it came to Creole Love Call, the melody, I said, oh, it's so beautiful, isn't it? Lovely. And I started humming, you see, this counter melody. And he said, oh, Eddie, he said, that's what I've been looking for. He said, that's just what I want for this number. I said, what? He says, what you've been doing there? What you've been humming? I said, oh, I said, I've been doing that sort of thing, but I don't know how to. I wouldn't know how to go over that again. He said, but usually you could do it. He says, try it. He said, I'll start again from the beginning, the chorus, and see if you can do it. I thought, well, try. And with that, he went out and stood in front of the orchestra. He started again, and I started to hum it. And at the end of the chorus, he came over and said, that's what we're going to do. We're going to record that in a few days. I said, I don't see how we can do this. It's because I don't know what I was doing. He said, leave it to me. And that's how it started.
Two things were happening at that time. First of all, it was at the launching, but when it was really catching on radio, it was first catching on. And we had a transcontinental wire, the Cotton Club, and we were broadcasting almost every night across the country.
From the Cotton Club, that's the thing that made everything, made people stop and think. Now, we're downtown, you know, we're downtown where we have those beautiful clubs, nightclubs, and excitement. What is all of this doing? What is this going on with the Cotton Club up in Harlem?
And at the same time, all the other big bands in the world are imitating Paul Whiteman and playing big, grandiose fanfares and all that kind of thing. And we had a very plaintive style. We thought of both things.
And I think the Cotton Club really helped the profession and started people, you know, understanding that there was plenty of talent in Harlem. And I think that was the beginning of everything. I think the Cotton Club and Duke, I think that began, that started everything going in Harlem.
The Great Depression of the 1930s was a period of hard times for America. Yet in spite of meager hopes and massive unemployment, people seemed determined to survive and to survive with dignity. More than ever, people had a need for entertainment and music in their lives. The elegant image of Duke Ellington epitomized the pride and sense of style of a generation, and his poignant, vibrant music gave voice to their dreams. The year Ellington and his orchestra went to Hollywood to appear in a movie called Check and Double Check, the first of what was to become a series of movies. Thank you. series was always suave and dignified, a distinct departure from the typical portrayal of blacks in Hollywood movies during that period. The village in Northern Richmond became a great source of pride for black Americans.
The greatest way to find out how good a man is to test him. A duke is the only guy who can direct a band, and no guys in a band don't give him no cues. He gives them the cues. That's what you call a director, man who thinks good.
And he could actually play the band the way he wanted, the way Average Cat played his instrument. He played the band. Just to give you an idea, he said to me once when we were making a record called A Drum is a Woman. And it was about New Orleans and Mardi Gras and all that. And he said to me, he says, sweetie, you're going to portray the role of Buddy Bolden. So I said, well, my sir, I don't know anything about Buddy Bolden. I said, not too many people around who know much about Buddy Bolden. He says, oh, sure. He said, Buddy Bolden was suave. He was debonair. And said he was just a marvelous person. He loved beautiful ladies around him. He had a big sound. He said he tuned up in New Orleans and across the river in Algiers. He would break glasses. He was so powerful. He loved the miniatures. And so he says, you know all these things. He said, sure. He said, you are Buddy Bolden. Play me some diminishes and some bent notes. So I started playing. He said, that's it, that's it. And that's exactly what came off on the record, The Drum of the Woman. So he could masterfully psych you into doing exactly what he wanted you to do.
I joined the band in 1929. I got the job through Johnny Hodges. And I never played trumpet. So we had a fellow in the band by the name of Joe Madden, Tricky Sam, trombone player. And so I stepped up about 6 months. And he came to me that he hired me to take this fellow's place. And I kept listening to Tricky Sam with the plunger. And I used to take plunger home and rehearse it. So one day, Duke said, you got it. Mm-hmm. So. And I told him, wah, 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 wah. He said, that's it, do that. And I've been playing the plug ever since. I went for one night, and one night led to a week. Week led to month led to years, and I wound up staying 28 years. So I considered myself privileged to sit in Duke Ellington's band for 28 years. I was privileged. And any musician you talk to, whether it be white, black, grizzled, or gray, wanted to play with Duke Ellington's band, believe me. Thank you.
Thank you. Ben Webster came on band, and that really solidified the whole scene. He had the big songs, and the truth, the feeling of what he thought he could hear was.
When Duke gets ready for that band to play, I still don't understand how he does it. He turns that band on like you turn that faucet off. And the band plays. But Duke's he's easy on me. He never said anything. Never seen Duke lose his temper. But he's got a way to let you know to take care of business. He did. And everybody broke. Yeah. Remember, that's the reason there's only one of them. He doesn't say, do this, do that, do this, do that. It's a little thing. You know, he's so slick, Eric. So that's the reason I say, that was really the biggest thrill of my life, sitting that band.
And naturally, he had to negotiate to keep his budget as you know, manageable as possible.
He was very shrewd and quite frugal. I think that because of him being as frugal as he was, that he was able to support his band over the years when every other band was unemployed. And he kept that band going all the time. I started off around $40 a week, $30 a week with Eddie Hazel. And then I went to the St. George in Brooklyn. That was around about 80-something bucks a week. That's all pretty good. And then when I joined Duke, I think I was making about $125 a week. What? I didn't know. I heard musicians make this kind of money, you know, but I never made any.
I went in and I asked him for a song that I thought was fairly decent. He didn't have any qualms about him, so he gave it to me. But after I got in, I found out there were guys making 2 or 3 times more.
It was a different feeling. It was a feeling of like security that you're going to know you're going to work, you know, things are going to work out for you year round and so on. You know, it was an establishment that would go on and on.
Duke was probably the most liberal leader I ever saw in terms of allowing his members to become completely loosely. She thought it was a lesser treatment to have alcoholics or drug addicts in the band than to discipline them and maybe fire them and be without some great talents. So even when probably 99 people out of 100 would have had a strong discipline problem and would have fired a musician or they had a real showdown, Duke very often said nothing and waited for the people to straighten themselves out. And it was amazing to me that he managed to have even the orchestra that he did, and it was a great orchestra, given the fact that there were times when the show would start and only 4 or 5 musicians would be on stage, you know.
Duke was smart enough to pit one man against another. And that's why Cat Anderson and Cootie would be on the two ends of the band. We would call them the bookends. And Duke would always be able to say, get in there, you know, he's outdoing you. And he'd turn his back to the audience, and you'd hear him talking to the band. And he'd really tell them when they weren't doing their part. So he was very smart about that, about working the men against each other and yet keeping them together.
He surrounded himself with the type of musicians that he liked to have around him. And he had to be qualified and be capable of doing what he wanted done. And his main statement to everybody, sometimes he would hit a discord on the piano and he would say rather vehemently, listen. And then sometimes when he gathered it, he simply meant that he wanted everybody to pay attention, you know, for the saxophones to be aware of what the trombones are playing, the trombones should be aware of the trumpets and so on, and the brasses are aware of the saxes of the band. And this was more or less his way of disciplining his band. And he would tell you in a minute, I am not a disciplinarian, so I've got professional people around me, and I expect you to do what you're here to do.
Duke's discipline was very much different than anybody else. Duke, his idea, he told me many times, he said, look, if I had to worry about my band, I'd be 6 feet under the ground right now. All my guys are over 21 years old. If this guy backs up for 2 or 3 days, all I can do is go to him and say, are you okay? Are you all right? I can't worry about them. They're men. They should know how to handle themselves. So as a result, sometimes the discipline would maybe fall apart at times. But it all came together at other times. When it did come together, it was almost too much for the listener or the musician thinking on stage. Because Duke had a way, for instance, when they had the Battle of Bands at the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem, when Basie's band battled Ellington or Basie's band battled Benny Goodman, there was never a point when Duke had to do it. He never got the guys in the back room like a football team or basketball team and said, hey, I want you to smother those guys. He never said a word. All he would say was, okay, fellas, we got a job to do, right? And every time, not only for me, but you can ask anybody during that time, whoever Ellington had a battle of bands with, forget it, because they wiped them out. I don't care who the band was. It was just one of those things when that band had to play with somebody else, that was it. They started out, and by the time they finished, whoever had to follow them, I feel sorry for him, because he left them nothing to do, nothing to play.
It's a funny thing about it. Sometimes you say, well, I know these guys are going to be dead after making this 500-mile ride tonight when they get in here, you know, and they get in there, and they come up, and they look, they've got a dark look on their face, and when they growl, maybe they drop something, and then they blow right up through the ceiling, better than ever, you know. Thank you. Thanks very much, Kat Anderson, Buster Cooper, and Paul Gonzalez. They're all three. She's going to pay too much. intelligent to be regarded as of the stride style of school, where the left hand continuously plays like a rhythm section, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, like that, which originally I suppose was for people to dance to when they didn't have drums or bass. The left hand plays like a dance rhythm, and the right hand plays against it with melodic patterns and versatile figures, trills and runs and whatnot, trajectories, that style. And that's the basic thing there. But Ellington, with his excursions into new sounds and harmonies, he adds this to, and he might very often when I'm playing a stride, he'll play a run that's like a splash of color, like you might take some colored sand and throw it up in the air and it drifts down. He'll make that kind of sound on the keyboard, and always experimenting with individual sound that strictly Ellington and no one else. I suppose you classical fans might hear a little reminiscent of Ravel tonalities in Ellington harmonies. But just the basic technique, I think, would be maybe a stride player. But then these other things are so interesting into harmony. Also a very important part of the Ellington trademark on the keyboard.
Play nine bars, and you'll play a bit of the first little part
of the eight balls he played already. And he'll play something else you haven't heard. And he goes back and plays and recapitulates and plays without releasing improvisation, because he'll do that and stop and start all again. He is an improvisational genius.
Absolutely. You know, Duke was a marvelous piano player, and because of the fact that he was so great as a composer, as an arranger, and as a leader, and a great personality, many people overlooked his piano playing. But he, any piano player who came along at that particular time would tell you that you don't fool with the old man when it comes to playing piano.
Been listening to is a master, the great Duke Ellington. It's called In Performance. This is within, well, this is Walter Dean, or Dr. Walter Dean, however you want to call it. I'm your host for Getting It Done. And I'm always amazed when I hear somebody like Duke Ellington play, because the man was an original individual with so many different abilities, God-given talents. He could not only play the piano, but could arrange music for every instrument in his orchestra. Not only did he write music, but also he, if you're listening very closely to what we were involved with today, is the ability to get 120% out of all of his band members when they were performing. Duke traveled all over the world and is known for
for his ability to communicate with all different forms of people, no matter where they lived, because of his sincerity in his music as well as in his personality. So we just can't have one show on a gentleman with such a genius ability. So this would be the first in a series of a number of presentations on the great gentleman who I consider to be one of the geniuses that led the way into the field of jazz as we have it today. His music transcends any other musician that I've ever had the occasion to know personally. I met Duke while I was in college, and I was running the curtains. And all he wanted was a steak and a drink before going on stage. His band was sitting on stage waiting for him when he finally got a chance to perform. So I had a chance to talk with him, and the next time we get together, I will tell you some more. So pay attention or pay some heed to next week's show, which will be part two on the great Duke of Ellington. We're going to close out our show with you listening to another genius who we already had a pleasure of listening to, and that was Earl Garner. We'll be closing out with him.
Have a nice day.